Please join me in welcoming Undersecretary Knight.
Not sure I'm going to live up to that promise of good news. What can you say about the Farm Bill process? I mean, here you have the most opportune time to reform farm policy since the 1940s. And think about it. Our farm policy really goes back to the 1940s. Some of you have heard me say this, back to the 1930s and the Dust Bowl and the 1940s. Our farm policy, many of those underlying structures, the underlying subsidies, the market intervention, those things, go back all the way to that time. You know, 1944, my father came home from World War II, still farming at that time, putting up hay with horses, still feeding the cows with horses at that time in South Dakota. And now we have GPS technology, we have the latest of biotechnology, we have the latest of chemicals that we use to be the most productive society in America, and we have a farm policy that's based off of the interventions devised during the New Deal in order to support farm prices. So here we are, we have record profitability, we have record prices in rural America, and we're using those same farm policies today. Now, for those of you that are in town, you couldn't be in town in a more exciting time. Farm bill's coming to a head. About, 2 hours ago, 2.5 hours ago, they finally posted the report on the Farm Bill on the web. That means throughout USDA, we have scores of analysts tearing apart the Farm Bill to look at what's in it. All across Capitol Hill, there are scores of congressional staffers that are getting their first glimpse at what's really in the Farm Bill and trying to discern what's there. Now, we all know about some of the big picture things, and I'll talk a little bit about that, but what folks have got to dig into now is what are the fine-tuned things? What are the earmarks that are embedded in the Farm Bill, and what are the implications of some of those things in this wonderful process? You know, all of you that have been involved in politics or write about politics or follow it, you know that politics is really the art of compromise. And what's the final thing that comes of this? And I remember when I was a senior in high school, we played Fiddler on the Roof in the musical in our high school. And I remember Tevye speaking in Fiddler on the Roof, and he said, "You can only bend and compromise so far before you can break." And I think from the administration side, we got a lot of folks that are feeling a lot like Tevye, that you can only bend so far before you can break. And I think this Farm Bill has reached the breaking point. President Bush has said very clearly that he is concerned about this Farm Bill and concerned about the implications of it, such that, in all likelihood, he's going to see fit to veto it. You know, almost 2 years ago, we went out into the countryside, the administration. We listened to farmers and ranchers around the country. Brought together over 20 of those listening sessions. We went to every state of the nation. And what we heard from people in those listening sessions, in those comments, what we published in that book, is we needed a farm bill that increases market orientation, one that has real program reforms, one that removes trade-distorting subsidies, and that strengthens the safety net for farmers and ranchers. You know, folks, if I went back and I put a score or a grade on every one of those things, increases market orientation, it fails. This is a less more market-oriented farm bill than what we had before. Includes real program reforms. It fails. We don't have program reforms. We have more programs being created with additional subsidies. Removes trade-distorting subsidies, comes into greater compliance with WTO, fails once again on making those reforms. Strengthens the safety net in a responsible way. It fails again. You know, I got kids. They're 12 and they're 9. You know, my kids bring home a report card like this. They're going to summer school. And I think the message here is that Congress is going to need to look at summer school for this farm bill as well. They can and they should do better as where we're going forward on this. We are in a time of record opportunities as it pertains to the farm bill. Yet, at this time of record opportunities, record profitability in farm country, we also have escalating food prices, greater and greater pressure on those the least amongst us, both in our society and around the globe. Yet, at that same time, Congress has seen fit to increase this farm bill from a $300 billion baseline to increase it by over $20 billion over baseline. Only $10 billion of that are actually offset responsibly. The other $10 billion is largely smoke and mirrors, sleight-of-hand adjustments in timings to be able to do that. Now, it really is.
I was about ready to ditch the mic entirely. Now, the real trick is, can I speak with only one hand?
Now, there are some good things in this farm bill. I got to be fair. As I look at things, there's increased spending out there for conservation. This is boosting funding for food stamps. There's improved support for specialty crops, and not without, I think they found the right balance on that. And it provides additional money for research on cellulosic ethanol to help balance our renewable fuels portfolio. That is all good that's in it. Now, it isn't often before an audience like this that I'm quote the Washington Post, but let me tell you what the Washington Post called this farm bill. This bill is, quote unquote, an overstuffed turkey. And that's because of what the farm bill failed to do that has been mentioned. Fails to significantly reduce subsidies for wealthy Americans. You know, we had an old-fashioned thing that we were talking about from the administration perspective, and that was that basically an assumption that if you lived on Long Island and you had a Park Avenue address and you had over $200,000 adjusted gross income, that perhaps we shouldn't send you a corn countercyclical payment. Now, we made some progress on that, but they've decided that that Park Avenue address should be able to get that payment if they have a $500,000 adjusted gross income, or $750,000 adjusted gross income if they got it all from farming. It also increased loan payments, jacked up loan rates for 15 commodities, and target prices were increased for 17 commodities. Now, this really didn't seem like the right year to be taking those actions when we could have, in fact, been adjusting the farm bill so that it is more WTO compliant in better directions in order to be able to reduce our deficit in keeping with the future for those same children of mine that I mentioned that are 9 and 12. And that's what we're really talking about here is, do you have a farm bill that is forward-leaning, forward-looking, and meets the needs of the American agriculture and of the taxpayers into the next century? You're here at an exciting time. Congress will take action. You'll see the debate in all likelihood this week.
on the floor of the House and Senate about accepting or not the package. Then it'll shift to the administration. I can't speak for the president. I think he's been very clear about his concerns. The president will have to make his final decision on whether or not to veto that package. And from that, you'll see the drama unfold on the farm bill. But there's no doubt about it. They can and they should do better by society, by farmers, and by taxpayers than what you're seeing today. Now let me turn, if I can, to a few other issues. I'll cover these very lightly and then open it up for questions from the crowd. First of those is for all of you, the reporters, many of you heard this before. I want to talk to you a little bit about National Animal ID System. This is a priority for us in protecting our herd health in America's farms and ranches. Our goal here is we're wanting to create 48-hour traceability on our livestock herd. We're encouraging farms and ranchers to register their premise as the first part of that. We've made incredible progress over the last year. We're at 462,000 premises registered voluntarily as I stand here before you. That's out of the 1.4 million target. We're adding about 1,000 to 1,500 per day or per week. And the key thing here is it's about protecting an individual farmer's herd health. What we want to do is be able to react in a state-of-the-art manner in the event of an animal disease so as to prevent us having to take any more strict or stringent action than is absolutely necessary. And as you know, all too often in a highly contagious disease, we're forced to depopulate those herds. If we can notify folks quickly, that circle, that concentric circle around that event will be as small as possible. That is the crux of what we're trying to do with Animal ID and why every speech I give anywhere in America, I encourage farmers and ranchers or folks who can repeat that message with farmers and ranchers to have them register their premise and participate in Animal ID. Now, another very topical thing that I've got on my plate that I should mention very lightly is country of origin labeling. It's contained in the Farm Bill. It's also part of the 2002 Farm Bill. We are facing a deadline of implementation of this by September 30 of this year. Now, let me give you a real brief summation of where we are today on COOL. Currently, U.S. law calls for labeling of most produce, red meat, and by September 30 of this year. Congress has delayed this implementation date twice on us. I do not expect them to do that again. We are already implementing this provision on fish and shellfish. That's been in place since 2005. Now, the Farm Bill's made several changes in this, mostly in pertaining to how we could implement it for red meat, creating several categories for mixed origin, plus a special category for ground beef. And that's what we've got to put into measure as soon as the Farm Bill reaches completion. Now, in that transition time, from here through the summer till September 30, I'm concerned about the market uncertainties that might be out there. What should a producer do now to ensure that they can implement COOL in an appropriate manner, not knowing what the rules and regulations are? I can't write the rules and regulations until we complete the regulatory process. So really caught betwixt and between. And what we've done is we have announced that for producers who choose to participate in the National Animal ID System, that participation will give them a regulatory safe harbor under country of origin labeling. If an animal has an ear tag in its ear that represents a NACE identifiable system, they've got official registration in that ear tag, they're carrying all the documentation they're ever going to need to make sure that their steak or their pork chop or whatever can go into the retail case and be accurately and fully labeled as U.S. origin. And that is the best thing that a producer can do now in the uncertainty that surrounds where we're moving forward on country of origin labeling. We will have it operational by September 30. You will see the rules this summer. Hopefully we can have those published by about July. And then we'll move forward in as quickly and fair a manner, in a manner that will cause the least possible disruption to normal commerce from the farm gate to the plate. Now, let me address one other issue or a couple of other issues on the regulatory front. And you saw from my introduction, my regulatory reach is quite extensive. And that has to do with where we are on biotechnology. And one of the particular issues that we'll see and we're going to work on yet this year is something that we call the proposed Part 340 rule. And that's in typical bureaucratic manner. We're naming it after the section code that that comes from. But here's the crux of what we're up to. Biotechnology has been regulated for the past 21 years. We've done a few updates, a few modifications, and a few changes to the regulatory mix of biotechnology over that time period. Those changes tend to be driven by the result of a particular experience or a particular event. It's time for us to look back at the whole comprehensive fabric and look at and say, what is the format? How should biotechnology be done so that it is forward-leaning and it addresses the need of farmers and ranchers over the next several decades? That's what we're going to do through this very comprehensive and very complete rulemaking and rulemaking process. We did an unusual thing with this. We actually published a draft environmental impact statement last summer before we published the rule to get that first wave of comments that we could draw on those comments on how to define the real regulations. We had about 23,000 comments. We're going through those. We're now in the process, working very closely with our sibling agencies that have a role on this, EPA, FDA, the White House, all up and down the chain of command, in making sure that we have the right approach to how to complete the biotech regulatory arena. There's several things that we're going to be looking at. These were outlined in that rulemaking last spring, so I can talk about it without violating anything. Looking at expanding the scope to include noxious weeds, biocontrol agents, using a multi-tiered risk-based permitting system, responding appropriately to adventitious presence, small amounts of biotech products in material in the environment. What do you do with imported commodities that will someday be coming into the United States? How do you properly regulate biotechnology in pharmaceutical or industrial crops in the future? And how should those differ from what we do with food crops? The list goes on and on, but this gives you an idea of what you'll see over the upcoming summer as it pertains to that. Now, there is also another effort on biotechnology that I want to mention very briefly, and then I'm going to open it up for questions from the floor. That is a continuation of something that we announced last fall, and that is the Biotechnology Quality Management System. BQMS basically is about how do you make sure that you have the best possible standards in place for quality assurance within the system? This should be very complementary to an initiative that the companies in bio have done called Excellence Through Stewardship, which emphasizes product integrity. We've set forth a two-tier system that you'll be able to start seeing as it goes into implementation. Level A is for the participants without formal quality management systems in place today. These are the small businesses and universities. And I'll tell you, that's exceedingly important in the experience we've had, making sure that universities meet the same standards as some of the other companies. And because of the number of startup companies I see out there as a result of renewable fuels, we need to make sure that we have the best quality systems in place with many of those startup companies as well, so that we are not destined to repeat the lessons learned of the last 21 years. We will also have in level B standards for the companies and researchers that already have formal standards in place, and have multiple sites with those cooperators. This will all be tiered into ISO standards, so it'll be a fully integrated system. But it's a means of having some of those things that you cannot effectively regulate, which is really about quality management, make sure that they are in place throughout the system as we move forward. In closing, you're here at an exciting time. You're going to get a chance to watch firsthand, with a little luck over the next day or two, much of the Farm Bill activities, maneuverings, theatrics. This should be a great effort to watch and observe in your roles. But let's keep in mind, whether we're talking about the lessons learned in biotechnology over the last 20 years, or we're talking about the Farm Bill, or any of the other ways, whether it's farm policy that reaches farmers and ranchers, or it's the regulatory arm that reaches those farmers or ranchers or the ag community, we need to have those policies look to the future, not to the past. Unfortunately, both regulators and policymakers tend to spend more time looking in the rearview mirror and trying to adjust to what's happened in the past than looking forward at where we need to go for farm policy in the future. With that, I want to open it up for questions, and I'll do my best to answer any that you may have. Ron, you're first up.
Bruce, you indicated that the administration would be, the USDA would be tearing apart the language of the conference report. Is there any possibility, are you going in with an open mind to say, if you see enough good things in there, USDA might say, Mr. President, you need to sign this bill? In other words, can we see a change apart at USDA on a recommendation?
I think folks will take a look at this in a very fair and open manner. The big picture things, you got a pretty good feel for. That even more minor crops are going to have target prices. They're adding target prices for peas and lentils and the soup crops. That's a definite. That they're going to try to offset it with shifts of when crop insurance are paid from one year to the next to mask the funding. That's a definite. That's pretty egregious. The concerns we have on payment limits, those are pretty well defined. So we're seeing those. What'll fall out over the next few hours or few days, those are going to be the earmarks, the special gimmies that are in there. We've got to look for more of those. One of those has already come out, a special tax exemption for racehorses. Congressman Boehner was on the floor of the House last night talking about a special, I think it's only $170 million for something for salmon in California and Pelosi's area. I don't know what that's about. We got a special provision. I got a barn on my place. I kind of wouldn't mind a little assistance to rehab the barn, but a special earmark for barn restoration. Those are the things that are going to fall out now over the next few hours when we start to see how much the earmark process in the appropriations process has bled over now to the Farm Bill and authorizations. Because traditionally, Farm Bills just didn't have that kind of narrowly defined largesse included in them. They were pretty much only the big stuff. Other questions? Yes, ma'am. The lady had asked about the ANSI process on stewardship. First off, sustainability. First off, the concerns have to do with the Leonardo group and the efforts they've done. They're trying to define a stewardship standard for sustainability that left most of mainstream agriculture out and by the side. They also left out the organic community, and I've even heard from the organic community, they're concerned about it because it's infringing upon their territory and their turf. We have spoken to the entity that's a derivative of the Department of Commerce, which is called ANSI, about this standard. It hasn't met the protocols that would be normally used when an interest group comes forth saying that this is a sustainability standard or an industry standard that needs to be used. USDA is making their voice heard. EPA is making their voice heard on this as well. So you can expect to see more efforts on that forthcoming. Yes, sir. Certainly, one's got to look at every one of those things. But from my role, I'm going to look at the Farm Bill the same way I look at a regulatory matter. I base the decisions off the economics and off of the science and off of the long-term implications of it. And so to find that a bloated overspending package is popular with a large number of interest groups is not real startling to me. But to say that that is the right thing to do and the right policy for American agriculture over the long haul is a very different scenario. And so we're going to take a look at those. We'll take a look. We'll be talking to members of Congress on where they're headed on the Farm Bill as well, and make a good, informed, solid recommendation to the Secretary and to the White House. Yes, sir.
Interesting that you phrased your comments in regard to the regulatory side with my question in regard to payment limit caps. Isn't it interesting that people who have enough money to buy land and choose to leave it in farming are now being told you have to make a decision whether that land is valuable to be farmed or whether you in fact should go do something else with it that pays you because we decided because of your address and how much money you already make that you no longer are eligible for a payment, either because of your size or your income. Isn't that the exact same concept as the conservation, now the conservation stewardship program? Our willingness to pay someone to continue to do a good job environmentally and leave farm ground farming?
Okay. I'm not sure I understand your linkage between farm program payments and CSP. Conservation Stewardship Program is based off of providing incentives and rewards to folks for leading-edge conservation. It does not idle land, as you were implying, at all. It's about a working lands program and about supporting working lands conservation. Now, the debate on payment limits is all about if you have limited financial resources in this world, and we do, and if you have limited federal tax dollars to disperse, is there a point in time where you are successful enough that you no longer need to receive farm program subsidies or assistance? And whether it's $200,000, $500,000, or $750,000, adjusted gross income, I don't know where you all are. For me, that's big money. And that still represents a tremendous amount of potential income. Remember, this is adjusted gross income. This is after depreciation. This is after expenses. This is the net that's on there on the bottom line. And so I think it's right to have that societal discussion as to what is the level of support one should receive and at what point of level of success should you not receive farm program benefits. I mean, I myself would love to not be eligible for farm program benefits under that criteria. I think that would be a fantastic thing to enjoy.
One last question.
Yes.
Projections over the life of this bill that most of these Okay. Let's look back at the lessons learned over the last several years. You know, you can look at it and say, for the most part, you won't trigger that. But remember what happened post-Katrina. Transportation came to a halt on the Mississippi River. As a result of that, you had prices plummet for a fairly short period of time. Things went below the loan rate, and people were able to put in LDPs, significant LDPs. They did not sell the grain at that time, but they were able to harvest the LDPs. And so folks were getting 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 cents a bushel LDP on corn and milo, and within a month that you had price recovery. And so while the long-term projection says unlikely, there is certainty the risk that it will trigger someplace, somewhere in those. Now, the other thing is, make no mistake, those loan programs and the resulting payments associated with those are the thing that is most likely to have in our farm policy WTO challenges pertaining that, because those are solidly not in the green box, but in the trade distorting arena. And so that's what's disturbing. 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 And so that's what's disturbing.